So this is just a really wonderful work of some pre-published and some new essays and works of cultural criticism, vignettes, frameworks of interview, archival research, reflections on memoir, FOIA, just, you know, when people talk about genre bending, it's always really cheesy, but I think you do manage that really beautifully. So I suppose the best way to start is if you could just sort of tell us what this book contains, what it is, what you hope it does.
Yeah, absolutely. And before I do that, thank you so much for doing this with me. I'm a huge admirer of your writing. I've been rereading Being Numerous, speaking of essays and genre bending and columns that are, you know, just so, so smart. But Being Numerous, of course, comes from George Oppen, who has a place in my book too. But I also wanted to thank Olivia, the great Olivia from Orr, and the Francis Kite Club. This is a great venue, and if it's your first time here, please come back. And to all of you for coming, if anyone can assure that this is sincere, you're an intimidatingly good-looking crowd. So if I sound a little out of breath, you're why. And I came in from a long vacation on a red-eye flight yesterday. So I'm trying to cure that with two cappuccinos and an Aperol spritz. So the book is, you know, a labor of love. These are many review essays kind of circling around this idea of flights. As I say in the introduction with little vignette with Seymour Hersh, flights out of print across a border and sometimes in a ghastly way into an early grave. But we are in a moment where this is intended to sort of be a prehistory for why we shouldn't trust narratives that tell us overly simplistic things about our party system and the moment we're in and who really supports violence and who doesn't. So yeah, so this is just a way to corroborate those who are doing current events work, you know, current political work like yours and so many others in the room here, both activism and, you know, critical writing through a lens that's historic and meant to be narrative. So it comes a little bit out of flights, which Olivia mentioned. And I do that a lot. Someone at one of these events asked me if the next book is a one-syllable F-word and what it might be. But yeah, Finks was an institutional history, and so I read the research until I saw someone crying. So it was also an emo history because the archive can be very unforgivingly boring until you have that eureka moment. But a lot of these have a relationship with Finks as sort of a younger sibling. I don't want to say there were leftover pieces of research that I wanted to cram into essays, but some of them, like the FOIA, like the Oppen, were FOIAs that didn't come through in time for Finks. And so the genre for essay, I think, is like the novel. It can contain what it needs to contain. And so that's what I tried to do with these.
And yeah, just so everyone, as if people haven't done their homework, very naughty, to give you a sense of some of the characters, the figures, the historic figures, both extremely well-known and some under-known, including, I would say, the wonderful poet George Oppen, who I hope we can talk a little bit about because I am an obsessee. But we've got characters focused on here from Malcolm X, Angela Davis, Leonard Peltier, and then James Risen, Cy Hirsch introduce us to the text, but Lorraine Hansberry, Graham Greene, surprisingly, Francis Stoner Saunders, people for better known and lesser well known, but the focus is around the Cold War era and continues to look at the functioning of soft power and violent state power in suppressing voices of, as the subtitle tells us, radicals. Radicals in the eyes of the state. But I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that term radicals, how it does apply to the figures that you look at here, what connects them in that sense, beyond just being considered radicals by the CIA and the FBI during the Cold War.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you go to lefty panels, a lot of times you hear that radical means getting at the root of things, right? It's one of the great cliches of those kinds of talks. But I think it's also sort of a, when you get tired of liberal fantasies, you start looking at other ways of imagining the world. And so there's a Malcolm X chapter where he defines radicalism, but even before Malcolm X's sense of by any means necessary, I think a year before he coined that or said that statement, Lorraine Hansberry was basically defining, saying the same thing in other words, by any means necessary. So there may be hints when the state uses the word radical that they're implying, or militant, they're implying that violence is a natural outcome of that kind of thinking. But I think the radicals that I was thinking about have more to do with people who are questioning the possibility of sort of establishment respectability politics when they don't seem to be working. And I would say, like, the sense of this, I mean, there's one of my touchstones is Arundhati Roy, who says that, you know, nonviolent protest absolutely doesn't work if the media isn't paying attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up in a probably traditional liberal, peacenik-y family. My dad was an absolutist on pacifism. And so I think I inherited that unquestioningly when I was younger. And I think I believed a lot of the, the slur words used by, let's call them centrists for lack of a better word, to try to discredit so-called far-left voices and movements. I remember even during Occupy reading and hearing this sort of mocking tone, you know, and I myself thought it was a funny thing to say when I heard some Occupy students use phrases like underemployed and overeducated. And I thought, oh, well, that sounds a little pretentious, but I later learned what they meant. But this impulse to sort of mock or to punch down or to call out, that's sort of the state and the corporate media's take on radicalism. But for others of us, I think there's something about yearning for a more complete history, not trying to repeat the fantasies of centrists whose half measures are acceptable and respectable, and looking for solutions that, or for ideas and even policies, we can say the dirty P word, that will ameliorate suffering. I think that's what I mean by radical, and obviously what the state means by it is shifting in this way that I described. It's sort of an aspersion that must be cast to sort of say that those ideas are violent and wrongheaded.
Right, and to maintain its own monopoly on what counts as violence or legitimate mm-hmm. violence. And obviously you see when you read these vignettes that obviously that the state will also maintain its monopoly on definitions, and that partly is through the work of soft power that was so predominant in the Cold War and I think works differently now. And I hope we can talk about that the functioning of the contemporary modes of censorship and how they have changed or not. But first I do want to talk about flight and the concept of flight. As you mentioned, it sort of means different things throughout the book for different characters. So there's flight in terms of exile, fugitivity, who has access to movement and stasis or not, and then sort of flights to infirmity, flights to death, early graves, the inability to move around the kind of control of the carceral state, sovereignty, border regimes. These all come up of like how we're bounded or not in the book. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the examples of different types of flight that come up in your text. And yeah, why this specific idea of flight seemed as the important connective point.
You know, if I have time to prepare for one of these talks, I'll sort of skim through it again. And I keep finding different kinds of flights, like in the Diego Rivera essay. You know, he's got the Detroit mural, and he's got this one panel where he has planes that are being used for commerce and to deliver food and good things. And then he's got planes with close-ups of pilots wearing gas masks who are dropping chemical weapons on mustard gas, probably in World War I. And then in the Graham Greene chapter, Graham Greene apparently did a little spoof. The State Department asked him in the early 50s to out himself to Time magazine as someone who'd been a communist in college, so that somebody very respectable, a respectable writer, could kind of mock the State Department's policy, the Hawks policy of putting everyone on trial who'd dabbled in communism. And it kind of backfired. So he was stuck in, I think, Mexico or Cuba when he was trying to come to the U.S. and film one of his movies. But then later in the, which isn't in the essay, it got sacrificed to my editor's need for a shorter essay. But later he does a fly along for I think Life magazine in Vietnam. He flew with a French pilot and he did like 9 drops of like 2,000 feet to drop bombs. And then he would pull back up and he's described himself as being, his knees were against the French pilot's back. And he wasn't supposed to do that. Journalist wasn't supposed to be in the plane dropping these bombs on Vietnamese people. But it ended up in the book. He changed the pilot's name, but he quoted the pilot directly, and the pilot said something like, it turns his stomach, actually he was dropping napalm, I'm remembering now, and it turned his stomach to be dropping napalm on innocent villagers who were being caught up in a sort of a defense of their sovereignty against a colonial power. But you know, we do what the politicians tell us, and by the time they give us permission to stop doing the bombing and to honor the peace agreement, it'll probably be the same peace agreement that they had in the beginning before the bombing stopped. So I read it and I see all these flights, but mainly I these kinds of things, maybe similar to the title of your book being numerous. It's like you read, you have the book together, you have something like a book together, you're editing, and you see something that can kind of serve as an open metaphor. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the flights are doing. In the best case, the repression that the state is offering, or in some cases the corporate media are offering, there's a solution that could not have been gotten at if not for the repression. And I'm not suggesting that repression is therefore good in any way, but it's been a necessary, let's call it evil, in these characters' lives in the Americas. That's the other selection of the book, all these stories. There are other essays that almost made it into the book until I decided that I was really interested in kind of a prehistory of our immigration policy right now and questions of sovereignty and borders. And so these are the American versions of this idea of having to sometimes have to come up with a flight of imagination as a solution to a kind of repression.
And there are these sort of wild stories of people having their passports removed because they're on CIA lists. And these are, you know, American citizens, but also the case of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who's takes a chapter of this book, who was sort of unwittingly, to an extent, drawn into writing for one of the CIA-funded, CIA-organized magazines, journals at the time, and actually the first excerpts from 100 Years of Solitude were published by the CIA. Weird story. And then Marquez was not then able to get to the U.S., even though he had been doing the inadvertent work of the CIA. And these kind of stories come up quite a lot in kinds of trappings and but manipulation at the same time.
Yeah, that was Garcia Marquez's complaint when he found out that the second and the ninth chapter of 100 Years of Solitude were, you know, excerpted in a CIA-funded magazine while, as a democratic socialist, he was de facto banned from entering our territory. So that was one of the archival eureka moments when in a little archive at Princeton University, I found his response to his editor, who had been a witting paid CIA editor, a smart Uruguayan scholar, biographer of Borges, and magazine editor named Monegal. And Garcia Marquez was not pleased that his new, like his book was sort of the literary equivalent of when Babe Ruth pointed to the bleachers before hitting, I think, a grand slam. Like, so many people, you don't know what that means. It's like cricket, but, you know.
Also what, but continue. Someone will understand the metaphor right. In the crowd.
He found out that he had excerpted his forecast masterpiece in this magazine called Mundo Nuevo. And he said things like, you know, it wasn't totally hidden that this magazine might have secret ties to the state, but he was of the impression, he says, that when you contribute to a magazine, you influence it more than it influences you.
Oh, that's very hopeful.
Very hopeful, very hopeful. But it didn't stop him from saying, you know, how ironic that you would smuggle me into your magazine without telling me who the real paymaster was while I'm banned from your borders. And just in case it's not clear, Mr. Editor, I will not write for you again. And, you know, but I still have sympathy for you and friendship, because, especially because we've been brought together in this idiotic state of cuckolds, is how he put it.
Cuckolds, but not in a fun way.
It was actually a well-written letter, go figure, Garcia Marquez telling off his editor. But yeah, these are the contradictions, and this is where sort of the book is, I guess, a sequel to Finks. And what the propaganda question in my mind is doing is, you know, it is a question around fascism, right? Like, we assume that fascist governments do a lot of propaganda. As a great democracy in the American century, we also assumed that we could do it better than our enemies, the Soviets. And like you say about fascism, there's a lot of things you point to when you're defining fascism. One, that it's consistent in the history and in the book, is propping up fascists, which the United States has done a lot of in Indonesia, but in this story, throughout Latin America. And you see some softness towards fascism, even in the Truman administration, when Paul Robeson, who had just been the victim, there's a great Paul Robeson filmmaker here from my hometown of Peekskill, whose films you should see. The Peekskill Riots is the title. So I grew up, I went to a public school in Peekskill, New York, just about 35 miles north of here. And I didn't know growing up that there had been these fascist riots around Paul Robeson's appearance to do something effectively for a banned early civil rights organization. And so the first concert in August 1949 was stopped by fascists. Mm. And it happened a week later. But jumping ahead, Robeson was trying to, in the Truman era, he was trying to put together a modest little proposal that would outlaw lynching. He got a meeting with Truman in the fall of, let's say, 48, maybe it was 49. And Truman said, no, it's not the right time for these divisive issues. Mm. And so the book is a meditation on propaganda for sure. And that's where Finks comes in. The George and Mary Oppen story, I had FOIA'd the government for Freedom of Information Act for those non-journalists in the room. You can get your own file, you can get other people's file, you can ask any branch of government anything you want about it, and most of them, even the FBI, comply. The CIA seems to have assumed that it has the most discretion regarding sources and methods. So the FOIA, this is before I knew how to do a FOIA lawsuit, the George and Mary Oppen files came to me after Finks was already out in the world, but all to say that, and I've diverged, I know, far from your question.
Can't remember what it was. It's all right.
You've got it written down. But this question around propaganda and Finks is still present in this book. But whereas Finks is an institutional history of that CIA cultural front, you also asked about soft power. The Congress of Cultural Freedom was the topic that I had to set up in Finks, even though when the book really, I think, started to become more narrative, it's when the characters start to become mm-hmm. real. And so this is set up in a different way, where it revolves around the same questions of propaganda, the CIA, the FBI, establishment media, and things like that. But each chapter is built uniquely around one, or in some cases, two characters. And the soft power, I think, does work. I mean, so the Congress for Cultural Freedom was looking at controlling intellectuals through its magazines mostly, and those magazines then would have editors who worked and wrote for much more mainstream magazines. And so ultimately, when it starts to get exposed, you see the CIA sort of clamping down and creating more spying domestically, which was illegal. So this little magazine program leads to things like the Church Committee hearings, where they're investigating the CIA's overreach and things, but it's a process that, you know, needed in Fink some description and some understanding on my part. The CIA also funded music and abstract painting and things like that, which others have written well about. That stuff doesn't offend me as much. When there's a historical narrative or a political narrative, as there are in little magazines, it became the concern of Finks. And I'll say one last thing about Finks, which is I was worried about being boring because institutional histories can be. So I read a character, Garcia Marquez, or there's a Baldwin chapter, until I found someone crying. And so in my head, I usually know better than to say this out loud in public. I called it an emo history. But this one, going back to the title and the concept, I wanted to sort of make it into an action history. So this idea of George Oppen driving through the desert, the Sonoran desert, to get to Mexico City, along with his friends in the Hollywood, anti-fascist Hollywood directors who suddenly had to be chased out of the country because of McCarthyism, or Graham Greene having, Paul Robeson not being allowed to cross the border, along with W.E.B. Du Bois, their passports being confiscated, and Garcia Marquez not being allowed inside our territory. That's sort of the first section, and, borders keep coming up. But to me, that was an important way to talk about this tendency, and whether in each case it makes sense to call it fascist or not, we understand it to go against our very clear traditions here.
Yeah, and I think it does a really nice job in all these examples of showing that the continuity between capitalist liberal democracy and fascism, that those have never been discontinuous, and partly that works through, acts of soft power and consensus building. I want to talk a little bit about George Oppen, just because fun, and then I think we should talk about, frameworks of repression now and frameworks of violence. But I wrote a book that was also an essay collection, as Joel mentioned a while ago, called Being Numerous, which is a title nicked from George Oppen's great work of Being Numerous, a great objectivist poem. I actually have a tattoo on my rib of a line from it. The force of days, having only the force of days, most simple, most difficult. And I kind of want more people to know about Oppen and his wife, Mary, but I actually learned a lot more from this chapter in your book. And I was wondering if you could talk about your feelings about Oppen and why he might be worth reading in your mind.
I discovered right after Trump became our president, I discovered a recording of Oppen reading the first half of this 40-part poem of Being Numerous. And he just had this very calming voice, almost sort of breaking, a deep voice, but soft-spoken. I guess he read the poem at the Library of Congress or something. And there was a lot of shock about Trump's victory, and there was a lot of takes on it that seemed to be mixed, to say the least, in terms of sincerity. And Oppen's voice struck me, along with the poem itself, as kind of the antidote to propaganda or insincerity.
That line that's like, an event as ordinary as a president, a plume of smoke in which people burn. I'm probably butchering the exact lines.
You got it right. And then a little bit later, he said, speaking of these atrocities that the American kind of capitalist war machine and imperialism must do, he said, if it is true we must do these things, we must cut our throats. Mm. And he had been in World War II, and he and his wife very nobly decided together that, he was Jewish, she was a Gentile, but that if they were asking others to go and stop fascism in Europe, it was immoral for him not to do it himself. So they made certain agreements, and she said, you must not throw your life away in a moment of heroism. He came close to doing that when he was, he was a truck driver in a hairy battle on the sort of German-France border. And he was filled with shrapnel when things got hairy. I guess an American regiment of black soldiers had been there trying to stop the Nazis the month before. And he was in this one, I don't know if it was a trench, but he was sort of holed down for a long time. He hadn't been able to take a bath. And then suddenly they were attacked. And he brought the body of a comrade over him, thinking about what his wife had asked him to do. The comrade was gravely wounded but still alive and was protesting what was going on. He asked for help. But initially, Oppen thought he would pull the guy out. There was a dead person also on top of that man, I think. He got a Purple Heart for surviving that. And when he picked up his flak jacket, the person giving it back to him, or maybe he was picking up his dog tags, nobody believed that that had been his flak jacket because of the damage it had taken. But he had PTSD, And he joined when Vietnam, when he came back from the war, he was, of course, McCarthyite'd. Mm-hmm. He was chased from his home in Southern California. For his earlier pre-war depression era work, stopping evictions in New York City, and then working with a labor union of dairy workers in upstate New York, both of which were made newly illegal after the U.S.'s pivot from fighting fascism to now fighting communism. And he, when he lived in Mexico, he saw himself as a political refugee. And a lot of his statements about the government, which may or may not have been recorded correctly, were written down by FBI agents. And it was interesting and eerie to read those when I finally got these files. But ultimately, he comes around. I mean, he wrote his last poems. His first book of poems came out in the Depression. And then right before these things started to happen, he saw the opportunity for his poetry to become propagandistic, because he was on the left and he saw a lot of left-wing poetry that was horrible. So he had this 28-year, if you count book to book, but 25-year when he started writing again, politically induced writer's block.
Let's all have a 28-year politically induced writer's block.
And then he published his book, and he was watching Vietnam. He was watching Vietnam unfold, and so he was sort of like building up his skill to write this very long poem that would bring in questions of solitude. He felt the most solitude when he thought he would die in Nancy, France, in the hospital after he was wounded far from his family. And for him, that was a devastating feeling. And so he came home with PTSD and was thinking about American violence quite a lot when he wrote those lines that you quoted, which really struck me as kind of an undersung proof. You know, a lot of what you hear in the soft power wars, you hear that art, literature doesn't do politics. It can't contain that. It always becomes propaganda. And so I think he was conscious of that challenge in our culture, in the Anglo-speaking world, of not lessening the art to encompass the activism or the political message. And he was a real stickler, but he was also thinking about crowds and cities and the strangeness of New York life. He has a great line about the horse races, which he strangely compares to baseball. But he has this line,
Baseball's not a game, it's an argument.
Yeah, and he's talking about horse races. Or he pivots quickly to horse races. Unclear line to me, but he also says, the shuffling of the crowd is nothing, well, nothing but the many that we are. And so he was seeing these crowds of people, and he was contrasting it with the feeling of almost dying overseas for what he still thought of, always thought of as a worthy cause, stopping fascism. And then he was being chased out of his own country. And then he finally was able to come back after 10 years in Mexico. And he was not allowed to have a passport. So for 10 years in Mexico, he had no passport. And then there was a Supreme Court case that ruled this illegal. And so he got his passport back just as his daughter was going to Sarah Lawrence. And he immediately started to write these poems that he thought could encompass his sense of World War II, and eventually the coming war. It's not a poem just about Vietnam, but the sections on Vietnam are haunting. And it's not fair to read them out of the order in which he writes them, but so please read them.
Yeah, read. But obviously, Oppen wasn't just a poet. He was an organizer, as you mentioned. And a lot of the figures that are really central to this book are not only organizers, revolutionary, and didn't shy away from physical confrontation, did not accept the state's definition of who gets to monopolize violence and what counts as violence or counter-violence. And I'm curious to talk about not just the kind of soft power and coercive frameworks of propaganda of the state and censorship, but the really hard brunt of the state that also disrupts the many that we are. So obviously COINTELPRO, and the mass incarceration and death dealing of these agencies, both federal and municipal, against Black Power and the American Indian Movement. I mean, Leonard Peltier is a character. Leonard Peltier just had his most recent parole hearing, and he was once again denied parole. The sheer absurdity of it. And so obviously these are ongoing sites of violence and state repression. And I also want to talk about the way repression works now in terms of censorship. We've also just been witness to what I think is the modern day McCarthyism against pro-Palestinian voices and Israel critics, and not to mention the very HUAC-seeming hearings we've seen in Congress against university administrators demanding names, essentially, to throw their faculty members under the bus for speaking against genocide. So yeah, like, can you talk a little bit about the violence and repressive forces being brought into the contemporary, what is continuous, what is different?
Yeah. Well, for instance, the Congress for Cultural Freedom doesn't exist. It was exposed. It should have been seen as naive to think that we could do propaganda officially without acknowledging that we were officially doing propaganda. But it was exposed. And so the cultural side of it may have gone away. It's not completely gone away, but in terms of a secret officially unofficial agency to do literary culture is gone. A lot of the democracy building that would have been done through adjacent organizations like the Congress for Cultural Freedom at the more political level, like the Free Europe Committee, is being done through a Reagan-created organization called the National Endowment for Democracy. But that's sort of the nerdy policy side of your question. I mean, I do see all of the McCarthy stuff coming back in the War on Terror. So in the McCarthy era, there was a famous case that my great-grandfather was involved in Berkeley, California, where professors were asked to sign a second loyalty oath after already sort of swearing to the Constitution that was intended to draw out people on communism if they've ever gone to a communist meeting. He wouldn't sign it. He was fired. He said to the professors who'd come from fascist Europe, who were not yet tenured, "We're tenured, we'll take this one on." They fought it for 2 or 3 years and they were fired. They lost their wages, but they were reinstated by the state Supreme Court. And in the War on Terror, I saw NYU doing something similar. It wasn't obviously about communism, but whatever it was sort of like this McCarthyite idea of like, be careful what meetings you go to, like, can you swear that you're loyal or whatever it was. I asked a friend to send me one, and it may be somewhere in my email from circa 2007 or something. But this question of passport control is back. The question of denying intellectuals rights to go abroad has happened again recently. I forget what the case was. It might have been somebody who was a scientist, an observer, a nuclear observer during the Iraq War, who was trying to go to a conference recently, who was denied a passport. But the question you raise of techniques that are back in fashion, very much up to the minute, regarding police and other repression of Gaza protesters, I mean, it makes me think of the way that our institutions worked during the 80s under Reagan in Central America. And, you know, a lot of the questions overlap around, you know, people like Rigoberta Menchú and the Mayan uprising. And the thing that we can say is that, like, there was another massacre, a shooting in Georgia today, I think it was in the Times on the way over here.
Georgia High School.
And it is just amazing to me that the Democrats have a position on guns at home that differs from their position right now on guns abroad, and that there's a Leahy law that prevents us from giving aid to people who are committing human rights atrocities, which was doubling down of an earlier law called the Foreign Assistance Act. And all I can say is, you know, the need to do that is something that strikes me as very Cold War, very McCarthyite, the need to cover up or to stop the messaging rather than, I mean, Paul Robeson's best quotes is worth me not flubbing it. So I'm going to just take a second. I know exactly where it is. The answer to injustice is not to silence the critic, but to end the injustice. And so if our own laws have to be contorted if our own laws have to be broken to continue a policy that may have had a strategic meaning at one point, but that meaning is being self-negated in terms of human rights, then it seems self-evident that in the future, the trust that you're hoping your institutions can inspire in people will be severely weaker. That's my sense of, you know, sometimes people come at me with arguments about wokeness or policing language and how hard it is for them not to have their feelings hurt because their language is being policed. But I do think that the policing of language is one of the few places where Americans feel like they can actually have an effect on their institutions, like even if it's, or not even on their institutions, but on each other, despite their institutions. Our institutions are so incredibly hypocritically broken in so many ways. And the Gaza stuff is severely accelerating that brokenness that is, I think, a function of Cold War stupidity, of Cold War, like deliberately putting a wormhole or a virus or a hole into your, you know, your app, your democratic institution app, so that you can spy on people, so that you can see what they're up to, so that you can make sure they're not talking to terrorists, you know. So I think that even if you're not willing to make a statement about the direct injustice of killing innocent people on an order of magnitude that's dozens of times over a kind of collective punishment, even if you're shy about denouncing that, and it should obviously be denounced.
Wait, cowardly.
Cowardly. You can also look at it just through the lens of we all want our institutions to be trusted in moments of emergency. And if this isn't a moment of emergency, I don't know what is. But the long-term damage to our institutions when we violate our own laws to do such incredible harm is impossible to overstate.
Right, and they have bought it on themselves, not just in the last 70 years, I would say also, but almost foundationally, but certainly the hypocrisy is right. But yes, also just this idea that who needs CCF when you've got university administrators as they are today?
Or when you've got, you know, the CIA making these ads about how diverse it is, you know, as it does its coups and everything.
Oh, yes.
The diversity of the CIA, they have their own social media and they're very cheeky.
And
they're
the
a cheeky lot, those CIA agents. They've got a good sense of humor, you know.
Yeah, and the vibes-based DNC, where no Palestinian voices were allowed on the main stage. And yes, what could, again, opens an event as ordinary as a president, ... in which people burn. Obviously, this is all quite grim, and it is a grim time. It's a time of live stream genocide in which we are all somewhat complicit and need to stand up, and many of us are, and we must continue. But these are also stories of resistance, obviously. Resistance through fugitivity, resistance against flight, through flight, in exile, beyond exile. I see that there are, you know, these are stories to learn from as well. And I was curious if you could talk a little bit about that side, not to end on a positive note in some sort of trite way. And after this, I want to open up to questions, but not to foreclose that there are stories of resistance to learn from.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I get every now and then at an event like this, which I guess comes out of like the American Indian Movement chapters and maybe the fact that the latest docuseries on Malcolm X, which I wrote the essay about for the Malcolm X chapter, proves that there were 9 informants in the room when Malcolm X was killed, and one of them was his head of security was giving him mouth-to-mouth in the Audubon ballroom when he was killed. The docuseries, by the way, got 2 of the 3 people arrested for his death off, one after he died, unfortunately, but at least the family had that small consolation. So a lot of the time I get this question twice now, I guess, or 3 mm-hmm. times. How do you know, like, if your protest movement is penetrated? And that's a very practical question that I guess indirectly comes out of the book. And there's no easy answer, but the history, and I'm looking at sort of the U.S. funding of fascism in Italy right now for the next thing that I'm writing, and I guess it has to do with a piece on Indonesia where we funded the very fascist Suharto dictatorship. When violence is eagerly suggested, now this is going to be a fun thing to say to you, given the first chapter in your book being numerous, this doesn't maybe apply in the same way as it could in other epics to Antifa. I mean, there's violence and there's violence. And so I'm happy to cite your beautiful essay about the punching in the face of Richard Spencer as a good thing and how people hemmed and hawed over that and the kind of anti-fascist, you know, violence that the 43 group did that your great-grandfather was in. That's a kind of violence that is worth thinking about and reading about and learning about, a lot of times when there's a kind of violence that's going to get an activist group broken up faster by the police, a lot of times those voices sort of eager to bring guns in to not to get arrested, because that's the tactic, but to get arrested for stupid, very dangerous things. A lot of times that could be, that's the best we can say, that could be the penetration agent. That's what people want to know sometimes when I come to these things. But, you know, Antifa is the great counterexample.
Well, I would still say with whatever organizing public service announcement, yes, if there's someone you have never met before and don't know well and who is not broadly vouched for, who turns up and is suddenly suggesting property damage, multiple felony worths of crime, and, you know,
beyond punching neo-fascists,
Red Army faction style tactics, they might be a fed. But yes, I think needs for security culture have a different valence a little bit these days, because we tell on ourselves so much. But no, I think it's a good point. Watch out for overly eager strangers. Keep your friends close and make close friends closely. But yes, sorry, you were saying.
No, that's all. And, you know, one of the things that came up in the Peltier essay was the phrase snitch jacket. Mm. There's an FBI agent who confesses to a documentarian that one of the aims of sowing paranoia was a technique where they wanted you to think somebody who wasn't an agent was an agent. Yeah. So they kept arresting her. Her name was Anna Mae Aquash. Arresting her and releasing her and then waving to her in public. And she got killed.
Yeah.
And they admitted that that was seen as a good thing to them. That was advantageous to the FBI. And so when the great Nick Estes talks about the reign of terror that followed the AIM occupation of Wounded Knee, where some 70 Lakota people were killed, and they were never investigated, these deaths. It's right to call it a reign of terror, and it's right to sort of look at this question that came up under Trump. Like, is the FBI really going to be our savior against Trump-style fascism, you know? Is the organization that's never really dealt with that part of its history in a satisfactory way? You know, Trump gave a huge whitewash to some of the history that was in Finks, and I was a little disheartened. But yeah, these questions around tactics are something that I was thinking of sort of passively as I was looking at what these people many years later. There's also a great guy who sounds like a combination between a Jimmy Hoffa figure, who is that, Jimmy Breslin, and he's talking about how when the Nation of Islam sort of muzzled Malcolm X because of his Kennedy remarks, the guy's talking to the documentary crew and he's like, sorry, this is going to be another baseball reference. It's like benching Babe Ruth right before the big game. You know, it doesn't get any better than that. And that was this guy's contribution to the film, was like, we loved that our work helped make them, because they were egging on this hatred between Malcolm X and his boss and the Nation of Islam. There were elements of why Malcolm X should question his boss, but they egged him on, and they even invited Malcolm. They went to Malcolm's house and asked him to be a paid informant. I mean, his response was pretty good, but when the rift continued and Malcolm was indefinitely muzzled by the Nation of Islam, they thought, yeah, mission accomplished.
Mm. Yes, avoid paranoia also.
Yeah, there was this guy, this was for Finks. I called this guy who had trapped and killed Che Guevara. He was in Miami. He went from trying to assassinate Fidel for the CIA in his early 20s or even his late teens, many years later, to helping track down Che in Bolivia. And he told this joke that I'd heard him tell many times before that he thought was hilarious. And it was about this period in right before Che went out to start the revolution in other countries, when Che became the minister, I think, of finance in Cuba. And the joke goes something like this. Fidel asks, are there any known economists among us? And Che raised his hand. But what Che thought, Fidel asked, was, are there any known communists among us? That's the whole joke. It rhymes. And so I let him tell me that joke to try to lower his guard, to see if he'd tell me anything new besides what he'd put in his memoir. But he was proud to not just have helped kill Che Guevara, but to cut off his hands and send them to Washington so that A, he couldn't be identified in a martyr's grave in Bolivia, and B, so that the home team would know that they had the right guy. But then after Finks came out, I was thinking about writing a novel, and I was reading Catch-22, and I wanted to write a funny CIA novel, which I hope one day to get back to, and I was thinking about how bad that joke was. So I tried to, and I was getting blocked. It was hard to find time to write, and so there is a joke in the beginning, a CIA joke, and the original version went like this. It's not funny. Let me warn you now. How do you know a CIA, it's two-part. How do you know a CIA agent is lying? His lips are moving. How do you know he's telling the truth? No part of him will ever move again. But I thought that was a little too wordy. So in the book, the second part is just, he's dead. I thought it was a little better than Felix Rodriguez's joke, but yeah. No, I mean, I think to back away from the joke and sort of just speak a little more sincerely about the CIA, I mean, as a journalist, Seymour Hersh, what I tell that joke to kind of contrast, like, it's an interview, it's a sort of a lunch with Seymour Hersh where I tell that joke. And to be honest, Seymour Hersh gets his sources not by doing this performative kind of jokey or serious kind of like battle with the CIA personnel. He actually lets it be known that he'll listen to anyone's story. And so he gets people to come and leak to him and whistleblow by not being the behind either of those jokes, Felix Rodriguez's or mine. So I was sort of telling myself that all this resulted from a CIA historian who reviews all books about the CIA not liking my book. And another one who was a former CIA guy under Bush for the Iraq War, whose name, by the way, was Steve Slick. And I wrote a response to him, and I thought that his name was going to be like in every line of my response in this magazine called Lawfare. And so I fall into the trap of sort of my thin skin sort of making me want to do this banter or writing back to bad criticism and thinking up better jokes. But I think in the opening section, I'm sort of telling myself not to do that, just to sort of listen and read and to talk to people. But I don't have any tips for how to find undercover CIA people. Yeah.
Yeah, and I wouldn't spend a lot of time looking for who's undercover.
I mean, I was thinking about this book as more a prehistory of our current immigration fiasco. And reading Natasha's book this week, I was thinking about the continuity between any kind of nativism. First of all, I mean, think about the greatness of that T-shirt. If you don't look like this, Geronimo and other Native American chiefs, then you're also an illegal alien. It's simple, but it's great. And thinking about immigration through that lens and then thinking about anti-Semitism in Europe through a similar lens where it was like this idea of who belongs here and who doesn't belong here and who's got a sort of a secret agenda. I mean, one of the craziest things about anti-Semitism was that, you know, in Europe before World War II, Jews were both bankers and communists at the same time, you know, and the flexibility around that was, you know, as needed, you know, depending on who these folks were talking about. But I can't pop off about that. I was thinking, I mean, the very last image of the book, I think, is one of the most important. The Obama administration inherited a coup from George W. Bush, whose fascism should not be underestimated by any stretch of the imagination. The coup happened before the Obama team could change over at State Department in Honduras. They were not thinking about Latin America very much. They probably changed over other staff a little bit faster, but you know, foreign policy wasn't Obama's thing, it was Biden's thing. And in Honduras at the time, they had Victoria Nuland, who's become our Ukraine person, married to a neocon, if not a neocon, but an appointee of George W. Bush. And the destabilizing coup has a long process of how it made itself permanent and how it made Honduras the least safe country for women, and then gangs and drug lords and everything else. And so people run away, humans, ordinary citizens run away. And by the time that process is becoming maddeningly fast for conservatives, you know, the key word here is caravans, and Breitbart sort of did the curtain raiser piece on this, and it quickly went to CBS and other news sources, this fear of all these immigrants without any real reporting on how that coup led to that. And so that circle of immigrants coming just in time for Trump to go down the escalator, the golden escalator, that same thing happened in Europe with the Iraq War. Huge amounts, millions of fearful people on the run from these wars on terror, just in time for those right-wing movements in those places to point to that as something that might take your job or take your funding, your social safety net payments or payouts, whatever it is that they're selling. So that image, I think, is the closest I could get. I mean, the book goes from the late 40s up until that moment in the Obama administration leading to Trump in terms of its chronology. So it's I have to say this, I feel like there's a certain firmness of ground you can stand on when you can get the actual files 10 and 20 and 50 years later in ways when you're writing specifically about the CIA and maybe the undercover parts of the FBI that you can't really be sure of if you haven't done the FOIA finding and things like that. So it's a timidity that is also an interest in sort of like inform, you know, people in this country, the historical knowledge is not something we always appreciate or gravitate to. So how these new findings in history inform our present moment is my whole thing. So tying that conclusion is something I do sometimes lazily and sometimes not at all, and sometimes through great readers. But we should ask Natasha that same question.
I'll just say a couple of points then to your question, then we should probably round up and then everyone can obviously hang and talk. So a couple of points, both in response to your question and in response to Joel's comments. So certainly what we've seen in the US and Europe are not just the far right and the connections of the center right to the far right taking advantage of silence around histories of imperial violence producing the current moment. This has obviously been ushered in by the so-called moderate center, consistently leaning towards far-right policy and rhetoric to hold off the far-right. We see that so extraordinarily in Germany right now with the victory of the AfD, the far-right AfD in the Thuringia elections. The centrist German party spent about, you know, 10 to 15 years speaking vociferously about how they must be a stronger border regime and taking anti-immigrant stances in order to hold off the far right with their anti-immigrant stances. Obviously, the grim continuity of, as I say, capitalist liberal democracy with fascism rears its ugly head. This is not an aberration, but a continuity. And it is indeed no accident that Olaf Scholz's response to righteous protest against Israel's genocide and German citizens and denizens' response to it was to call for deportations, as we're seeing here. You know, we can talk about statecraft and deep statecraft, you know, and what will be found in history now, and the, you know, the importance of speaking truth. But we have, more than perhaps any other generation, seen enough. We are watching a live stream genocide. This is not a question of knowledge. This is a question of brute power that we need to build against. So yes, I'm not saying, and to use that, you know, classic phrase of logic, necessary and insufficient. It is, of course, necessary to speak truth, to tell the truth against the propagandistic framings of, for example, this ongoing genocide and the euphemisms around it. Those are crucial, but it is not by virtue of a limitation of knowledge and shared knowledge. And, you know, I actually learned a lot of this, an understanding of this issue through the scholar Zoe Tsimoutsi, who made the point that, you know, we've been looking at lynching imagery for decades, for centuries. We do not need to see more as a point of proof. This is not a question of knowledge and proof. This is a question of resistance, which might require a core of knowledge and understanding, but the deep insufficiency of it should be gnawing at all of our cause. So yes, being together, being numerous in more resistant ways, I think is the only way forward, and following certainly the Palestinian organizers doing that steadfastly is what I think we should be doing.
Wait, before Liesl's good correction to what I said. That most of the best quotes in this book are literally by someone else, because that's how I did the research. And so that is a better answer to your question than mine, and I recognize that. And that's part of why I asked Natasha to do this. But it's also worth saying, you know, I mean, Macron speaks to your German example the same way. And the Columbia students are back out on the street now getting arrested, and so should you be.
But don't get arrested on purpose.
Yes.
it might come
without down. Knowing anyone and telling everyone else that they should get guns.
But yes, all throwing, as Diane de Prima made clear, we must throw everything at this.
I'm glad you brought that up, because there's something that I think you were getting at with your question about soft power and propaganda that I didn't answer, which was this whole idea. I think this applies to what people have said. There's a scholar who talks about under capitalism, liberalism is the good cop and fascism is the thug, the bad cop that's brought in when capitalism's basic tenets are being too directly questioned. And so I think there's a similar function. It's a sort of Trojan horsing, isn't it? Like our faith as the sort of inheritors of Western traditions and the Western Enlightenment during the Cold War and during the War on Terror, there was this Washington consensus. And so liberalism was used as a Trojan horsing technique and progressivism. When in Latin America, the liberals, which in Latin America means conservatives, when the centrists and the right wingers were the only ones reading the first literary magazine of Latin America, which was called Notebooks for Cultural Freedom, when that one wasn't working, when it wasn't getting the progressives who were thinking about Cuba, proud of Cuba, when nobody was reading this first sort of conservative CIA magazine, they realized they had to Trojan horse. They had to pose left. They had to look just too left enough. So Garcia Marquez was a known democratic socialist. So someone like him, for his creative work, would be on the cover, but then inside you'd have op-eds defending American coups. It was a brilliant, brilliant Trojan horsing. So you're looking like you have progressive values, you're getting progressive readers to come, and you're trying to change their mind about an American coup. That's Trojan horsing. And that's kind of, you know, what the United States does with soft power and with its bragging about its liberalism.
I don't know enough about blacklists. If I knew, I would share them. I don't feel at risk, because I think the scale of risk that other people are facing, your comrade, there's not a single university standing in Gaza. Journalists, over 172 journalists have been killed. I'm sitting in a lovely bar in the Lower East Side. I don't feel at risk at all. And that's not being brash. I honestly think we should consider ourselves at various scales of precarity and safety. I would honestly point to the work of my colleagues who are better than me at investigative work. I am more of a columnist. So I point to the work of Gila Lacey, Liliana Segura, Ali Gharib in continuing that work at The Intercept, whereas I will offer angry commentary forever. So I can't tell you who's holding blacklists or not, but I assure you there are lists. Lists are plenty. I don't think that's going away anytime soon. And sad to, yes, state power will remain violent until challenged.
And there are people in the room who've recently had their livelihoods and tenured positions overthrown and negated for their attempts to talk about this moment that we're in. That is something we should talk about over a drink. I think there's a band that has to follow us at some point at 8, and we should all talk, and I'm supposed to sign, but
Joel, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.